Hi, my name is Marie, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Okay, thank you. You know, this is kind of a different thing because I know that the rest of the weekend is going to be about the steps, and so I'm not going to take you through those kind of things. I just want to kind of let you know who I am and where I've come from. I want to thank Peter and Marion and all the people that we've spent time with, and we have people here that we've known for a long time, and we've, you know, we met them last year, and they're just, this is one of the things we did with Fellowship of the Spirit was that we proclaimed that we wanted it to be a family reunion, and that it feels like that here, because, you know, the faces are familiar, and then, you know, this is our family. So, my history, I came from Indiana. That's where I grew up. I grew up with a father who was what I call a militant atheist. He grew up in West Virginia, and his mother told him when he was young, a young man who was really interested in the stars and things like that. She said, "You have to choose between God and science." And my dad was a brilliant man and really devoted to science, so he chose science and ran away at 16 to pursue what he wanted to pursue. He put himself through high school. He put himself through Johns Hopkins. He went to Wabash, and then he went to Johns Hopkins and got a PhD in biochemistry. And I tell you that because he was really committed to the proposition that we are our own gods. We are who we look to. We are we look to knowledge as the foundation of our lives. And so that's what I grew up with. And you know, I didn't question it. I was a kid, and he was a very, very powerful man, a powerful personality. He had power in the community. He was a big man, a lot of white hair. And he was very, very a large presence. And so it's not that I question that. That's what I grew up with. I'm not going to take you through a whole lot because it's a kind of a shortened talk tonight. But I went off to college. But I will say that my personality was one that I was an extreme introvert, and I was not comfortable with people. My plan B was to get marooned on a desert island and get rid of all these messy relationships. I could have a relationship with the trees and the coconuts and stuff like that, and that was much more manageable for me. So I went off to Colorado to college, and I had been very, what would I say, straight-laced when I was in Indiana. Was the way that I could get by without too much attention. And I got to University of Denver, and I kind of threw open the doors. And it was in the 60s, so, you know, drugs were the rule of the day. And so I did, mostly I did mescaline and pot. And not too heavy, but heavy enough. And I was really, my dad had always said, you need to find your own truth. And it sounds great, but I'm coming from zero, and I'm supposed to figure everything out, right? And so that was the easiest plan, okay? Get some drugs, find my, you know, bean or whatever it was that I was looking for. And so I kind of flip-flopped around a lot. The drugs were a part of a scene where, you know, free sex was a part of the scene. Rebellion was part of the scene. Sit-ins were part of the scene. It was all kind of an outfit that I put on in an attempt to find me. I didn't even know, actually, in a way, that there was a me to find. One of my favorite quotes that I heard for the first time, but I really lived by it. I'm not going to do this well. We wrap ourselves in the bandages of self, afraid that if the bandages are taken off, there will be nothing underneath it. And in a way, and I've been doing some recent deep inventory, and in a funny sort of way, I wanted to be invisible. And in a way, I was really scared of being invisible. I was scared that I was invisible. So, long story short, I had this very big personality father. I felt about this big in my life. And I figured that's who I was. And so I had to find a big personality partner, right? Well, actually, I didn't want to find a partner. That was not in at the time, you know? It was like, okay, you just go your way, you drift through life, and then you die. And but what happened was, just as I was reaching the end of my college time, I found a really big personality. Him. And you know, I was thinking about this the other day. Al-Anons tend to, not all the time, but tend to either supplement their own smallness with a large personality spouse, or they look to find somebody that makes them feel superior to them. So they get somebody who's really screwing up all the time, right? And you know, they feel very righteous because, you know, this guy over here is just going nutty. And
you know I'm in the room.
Oh. Yes, can I have my water, please? Nikki, can I have? And so, anyway, I was really comfortable with this large personality person, and I didn't see the drink as being anything strange. I was doing drugs, he was drinking, you know. And so, I had also not planned on getting married, as I say, and so. We've been dating for 2 months, I guess, and he, and I'll let him tell you the story about meeting me, but, you know, I met him, and he filled in all these holes of you know, I was not a talker, I was not a doer, I was not a, you know, I was kind of trying to fade into the background. So I would listen to these stories that he would tell and this passion that he had about life and this, you know, and all this stuff, and it was just thrilling. But I still had the commitment not to get married and, you know, go off and do that. And so it may have been about a month and a half into dating him, and we're driving along in his Volkswagen, and this voice comes out of the nowhere and says, this is the man you're going to spend the rest of your life with. And I'm going, what? I mean, I had no concept of anything beyond me. And he... And he repeated himself. And he said, this is the man you're going to spend the rest of your life with, which I didn't really take seriously. Okay, you know, we hear God's voice in various ways, and sometimes we don't take it seriously because, you know, God's talking to me. And about 2 weeks later, we pull up to my house after a date, and he says, would you marry me? And I'm going, okay, what did I say? Well, I say, no, thank you. I say, well, you know, whatever. And I said, yeah. Like, what? What did I say? I said, yeah. And so I wasn't feeling good the next day. And in more ways than one, okay? But I decided to go to the clinic, and I went to the clinic, and she said, well, I think you need to sit down. And I said, okay. And she said, you're pregnant. And I got this, now, really, I was not going to have children. I was not going to get married. And this grin started on my face. And so I went home, and I called Mickey, and I said, Mickey, I think you better sit down. Mind you, we had only known each other a month and a half, okay? So I said, you're going to be a dad. And the joy that he showed at that point was crazy. It was miraculous. It was huge. We went out to lunch. He told everybody in the restaurant that I was pregnant. We were married at three months after we met, and we're at 48 and a half years now. Wow. With 6 weeks off for bad behavior. Amen. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was on down the line, okay? But kind of what I'm telling you is that who I was, I couldn't make decisions. I was full of fear. One time Mickey said to me, he said, you know, you're afraid of everything. And I said, no, I'm not afraid of anything. He said, no, you're afraid of everything. He was right. And, you know, I had built up the thing that we do. And I had the answers, and it felt like I was in charge. And if something didn't fit in there, I would just kind of push it away. Okay, but I was afraid of everything. I never spoke my mind. I was always, it was June Cleaver. You know, that's who I was. And the fear that I had in living my life, looking back on it, was so unacceptable, but acceptable in a funny sort of way. I had gotten very used to it, okay? We got into our marriage, had our daughter, and got into our marriage, and he was acting funny, you know, kind of weird. And so we would sit down sometimes, and we'd talk about putting him in a nut house. I didn't see the daily drinking. I didn't consider it my business. I didn't, because I didn't see it as a problem. So my attitude towards it was, he's just off, you know? There's something really off about our lives and about him. Fortunately, I had, through God's guidance, had met up with a couple of different people who were in Al-Anon, one of whom I was babysitting for her little girl. And she said, I go to a program that's called Al-Anon. And she said, and it's free, which, boy, that hit a chord with me because we were dirt poor. And she said, and you get to talk about things with other people. And by that time, I was even more isolated, and I was withdrawn. I had my little girl, so she kind of filled all the lovey holes, you know, where, you know, you have your purpose. And so, you know, I thought, well, that's great, but you have to have an alcoholic to go there, right? Kind of. And so I'm like going, well, my dad, no, he didn't drink that much. And I'm going through everybody that I knew to see if I had somebody so I could qualify for this program. So when Mickey announced that he thought he was alcoholic, I was like, yes! That's great! Now I can go to Al-Anon. So I didn't have to get convinced to do it. But as far as my history goes, I had a really hard time with looking at myself because I had never in my whole life even considered that as something I needed to do. So the real breaking point for me was that I did get a sponsor, and she told me out of her own need, she said, at 2 years in the program, you have to sponsor an Alateen group, which was a lie, okay, but, you know, it worked. And I was a mess. But she needed an Alateen sponsor for her daughter's group, right? And so I went in there, and I didn't grow up with alcoholism at all in my family. It was pretty clean that way. But I went into this group, and Alateens, I don't know if you've ever been around Alateens in the setting of the program, but they're raw, they are honest, they are disturbed, they're frantic, and they're alive. And I really think, I did that for another 10 years, I believe, but I really think that they raised me in a way. They gave me a chance to be really alive as a person because they were so raw. And that was like my entrance into being vulnerable. Vulnerability was a death threat to me. And here I was in an alcoholic marriage, and I was unable to be vulnerable or honest or in integrity, anything. I was really stove up. It's the best way I can put it. So the Alateens really raised me. And, you know, all my step work, I'll, you know, share that as we go through, but I'm not sure if there's anything else I need to tell you about me. Is there? Remind me.
Chapter 2, chapter 10.
I have been in the program since February 12, 1974, and I don't think there has been more than a week gone by that I haven't gone to a meeting. Maybe I was sick and I didn't, but it's a commitment. I believe in the program so much. And, you know, there are a lot of Al-Anons who say, well, it's exactly the same as AA. We just don't have the drink problem. And my opinion is that it's not. It addresses different issues. It addresses what we do to live through other people. Alcoholics have their very own set of problems and blessings, and I love alcoholics. They're great. I mean, there's a passion in an alcoholic. Even if you're killing yourself, there's a passion to it, you know? So Al-Anons get a little wishy-washy sometimes, you know? They're like, okay, you behave and I'll be fine, you know? And And so there, you know, there really are different issues. In Denver, we have so many double winners that there are meetings where it's half double winners, which is you're in both programs. So anyway, I'm committed to the program. I believe in the program. I am sponsored. I'm sponsored once a week. I do 10 step. Again, I'll share more about the steps later, but I really believe that the way in which the Al-Anon, or should be Al-Anon, potential Al-Anon, and alcoholic fit together is a very special, unique kind of thing. And we can't break it away without help. We can't keep it together without help. And so to have Al-Anon and AA conference together, talk together, work these steps together, communicate together is, I think, essential. I definitely don't think it's essential for us to have combined meetings unless it's what you kind of like, but I think it's important to keep the programs separate and then together, and this is together, and I love this. This is great. So more this weekend.
Can I just start crying now, or? Okay, I'm a crier. We're going to have to put up with it for a weekend. It's anyway, I just tell people I've earned these tears. My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. My AA birthday is February 12th, 1974. And I sponsor, and I am sponsored weekly. And I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm certainly in love with my wife. Actually, I prefer to stand up and talk about her. So we get these gifts, and sometimes we recognize the gifts, and sometimes we don't, right? So Maria and I jumped into our lives together, but I'll start before that. I come from a family in which I am the only alcoholic. My parents are not alcoholic. I have two brothers, older brothers. They're not alcoholic. But you wouldn't know that I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family, because I'll tell you, there was a whole lot of drinking going on. And there was a lot of violence, but that wasn't physical violence. It was emotional violence. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't fall asleep. I didn't understand why I could not just fall asleep. Because if I fell asleep in my house, World War III is going to bust out in Munich, and I'm going to be deep in it. So I was guarded. And I can remember my big brother used to come and hold me in my bed, because I was so scared. And so I started out in that situation. Now, I want to talk about which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Does alcohol cause alcoholism? Does alcoholism cause our addiction to alcohol? You know what I mean? And that's a very, very important issue. Because if alcohol causes alcoholism, then all we have to do is put alcohol away and we're home free. But if alcoholism, you see, brings on the alcohol, and we stop drinking, we're going to be stuck with alcoholism. And that's, quite frankly, what we're here to talk about this weekend. But all of that's sort of in hindsight. So I grew up very easily. I was kicked out of every school I ever went to until I got into high school. And it was not like, you know, we need to have a parent-teacher conference and talk about Mickey. He seems to be having some problems. It was like, get the hints and don't come back. I was very angry. My parents were like caught up in career. You know what I mean? And I would normally, when I grew up, I would never tell people what my dad did. I would never tell them because I grew up in the military, and if they found out what my dad did, they would just beat my ass. So my father was he pretty much ended his career as the head of Air Force Intelligence in Europe. He was like a big deal. And so my mom's mission and devotion was to my dad. Do you know what I mean? His career came first. Let's further his career and do all that stuff. Two older brothers, they're 5 and 7 years older than me. And so what happens is I had to raise myself. And I did a really terrible job. And so when I got sober, there was a chart on the wall, and it was like a horseshoe. And it was Dr. Jelinek's chart. Anybody seen that chart? All right. It's a long time ago, but that chart was kind of like based on this. We start out in life and we're born and apparently like we're all pure and, you know, we're just that cute little baby. And then we come down here a little bit, life starts to happen. And then we start to drink and we go down the horseshoe and we hit bottom. And if we get help, then we can climb up the other side of the horseshoe and we get to the top and the sun breaks out and the angels sing and it's all good, right? And there was even a movement in some parts of Alcoholics Anonymous to change the name of our disease from alcoholism to Dr. Jelinek's disease, which may sound bizarre, and it does. But what, what they were trying to say is, guess what? This disease exists outside of the bottle. Outside of the bottle. Imagine the Mormon community. If like the common wisdom is that 1 out of 10 people in the world are alcoholic, now we have the Mormon community, they don't drink. And they have alcoholism. Anyway. So I grew up and I was angry and I grew up in Europe. And so I started drinking when I was 5 years old. And I drank from the time I was 5 years old until I was 27 when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at the York Street Club in Denver, Colorado. And in the meanwhile, I was like, there was a woman who came to my home group a couple of years ago from California, never saw her before or since. And she was talking and she said, you know, if I had committed suicide while I was drinking, I would have murdered a stranger. Can you hear that? As I look back on my life, I cannot believe what I did. I cannot believe who I was. On the one hand, I wanted to be a Catholic priest. On the other hand, I was a vandal. And I was a nightmare to have around. And so I'll just give you a little quick slice of what I was like. So when I was growing up, I walked across all the battlefields of Europe. And we were there not so long after the end of World War II. And so I was really hooked into things. And I had gone to the flea market in Paris. Now, if you've ever seen any or been in New York in Fifth Avenue where the garment district is, you know they'll get big racks of clothes and they run them on the sidewalks. They're going from here to there. And they've got all these clothes hanging from those things. Well, imagine that, all those racks of clothes with German uniforms. All these German uniforms. Imagine all their knives, their swords, all their decorations, everything are for sale in the flea market. So now we fast forward to the eighth grade. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I'm in Catholic school, and it's in Rapid City, South Dakota, and we're going to have show and tell. And so we're going to come, and we're going to show those things that this is special to me. So I go in and I want to bring all this Nazi paraphernalia to the eighth grade show and tell, and they weren't having it. So in those days, like nurses wore uniforms and starched uniforms and they had caps and, you know, and they had a shoe polish that was liquid shoe polish, and there was a cotton dauber on the end so they could keep their shoes looking nice. So on Saturday night, I got one of those things, and I put swastikas this big in every window in this in Cathedral Grade School in Rapid City, South Dakota. I can't imagine who that was that would do that. And on Monday morning, the principal came around. Now, I preface this by telling you that I was a new kid in town, and I had just come to this school. I'd grown up in Europe, and then we came to Denver, and then my dad retired. And so now we're in Rapid City, South Dakota, and I'm the new kid in town, and they elected me class president. Oh, my God, what a story this is. What a life this is. So I'm the president, class president of the eighth grade. I put the swastikas in the window. And so the principal comes around and she pulls my Confederate, Dan, out of the classroom and he doesn't come back. So the jig is up, right? I'm screwed here. So she calls me out and the first thing out of my mouth is I said I didn't do it. She said, you didn't do what? I said, I didn't put swastikas. Blah, 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 blah. So once again, and in Rapid City, in that school, you graduated and you had your first dance. And the guys got dressed up and the girls got their dresses on and you got your first formal dance. And I stood across the street from that dance in my vinyl motorcycle jacket, drinking Grain Belt beer, and smoking old gold cigarettes, and to hell with you. And when I got kicked out, I forgot the tribunal. So after the swastikas, they set up, like, picture this is the basketball court in the school. And all the way back there is a table with three priests, and they're all lined up, and I got to walk all the way across the floor. I wish I could go back and get that kid and put my arms around him and say, come on, man, let's talk. So I walk up to the table, and Father Iceland, nice name, right, was in the middle. And he looks at me and he says, Mr. Musset, what are you, some kind of communist? And I'm thinking, this guy doesn't see the swastikas. I said, no, Father, I'm a Nazi. So we got that one out of the way. And so I went home after getting kicked out of school that day, and I drank a bottle of creme de menthe. Look, it just had alcohol in it. That's all I could, you know what I mean? Oh, my God. So I wanted to be a Catholic priest. I had half of me that was absolutely invested in being a Catholic priest. And I was accepted to the seminary. And I didn't know this. My mother told me later in the eighth grade. So I would go to high school at the seminary and go on into college and get into the priesthood. When they came to collect me, my mother knew Zippo about this and told her what was going on. She got a broom and ran him off the porch. So I stayed in school. So, you know, Bill Wilson had that moment where he went into Winchester Cathedral and he stood there and he knew there was a God. So it's the summer after the eighth grade. We're moving back to Denver. And I went into the cathedral of Cathedral Grade School, and I stood in the middle of the church, and I looked at the altar, and I knew there was a God. I knew there was a God. But I'd gotten on the train of alcoholism and alcoholic drinking when I was 5 years old. And that train was waiting for me outside that door. And I got back on that train, and I drank till I was 27. I violated my very nature. I violated everything I cared about. I violated everything that was holy, everything that was good. So I can tell you, if I told you that I used alcohol to manage my alcoholism, would that mean anything to you? Right? I didn't know that. But I used alcohol to manage my alcoholism. And I found that out when I got sober. I did talk with Maria about what nut house that we could put me in because I was coming apart. And I got lost. What am I talking about? Yeah. I am lost in the tall grass. This is going to happen repeatedly. Get up here. So in any event, by the grace of God, that was the last time I got kicked out of a school. I went to a Catholic high school in Denver, and there was this senior English teacher, this nun, and she'd been watching me come up through the ranks, and I'd really calmed down a lot. And I remember before school started, she pulled me into her classroom and she said, Mickey, and she asked me this really strange question. She said, Mickey, what do other people think of you? And in my whole life, that was the first time anybody ever asked me to be objective. What do other people think of you? Not what do I think of them? And she had, the sign on me, man. She had she was magic. She was this magic woman. And I loved her so much. And I would stand up in class and say something outrageous or whatever. Like I stood up and said, you don't have to love yourself to love others. She'd say, do a paper on it. And then I would, present the paper. This is senior in high school. So I went around the country for 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous telling people about this nun and how much I loved her. And one day a light bulb went off and it said, you know, Mickey, you never told her. So I found her and I went and sat across the desk from her and I told her how much I loved her and what she meant to me, because she didn't run from me. She didn't kick me out. She didn't get rid of me. And I would have jumped through fire for that lady. I don't know if I'm painting a picture of what I was like, but I can tell you that I wouldn't want to go back for anything in this world. I wouldn't want to go back because I was raised in a military family, and it was like if you were two-fisted and you could knock somebody on their butt, you were a man. And I was like, I didn't want to do that. I never wanted to hit anybody. I just can't imagine ever hitting anybody. And so I thought I was not a real man. I was very, very emotional. I was very intuitive. And so I thought I was gay. Now, if you're gay, you're gay. There it is. And so I got this sponsor. Now, I just want you to see God working here. So I got, both my brothers fought in Vietnam. My father fought in World War II. I got bad knees. I could not get into the military. Once again, I'm not a man. And so I need help, and I get sober. And I'm like in this group, and I'm, it was a very tough group. This was like, they took tough love over into abuse. Honestly, they did. I'm serious as a heart attack. And so I'm looking at this group, and it's time for me to pick a sponsor. And I look over, and there's this little guy, George, and he's got a buzz cut, and I figure I can steamroller this guy, right? So I asked George to be my sponsor, and having questions about what it means to be a man. I got all this going on. And so what I got is a gay sponsor. God is so kind. I got a gay sponsor who just came back from 3 tours in Vietnam as a Navy medic attached to the Marines. He's probably the toughest man I ever met in my life. And for 2 years, George would not let me go. He would not let me go. And he walked me out of that valley. Like, I would go over to see George. George had all the war he wanted in his whole life. And so he was studying to be a Methodist minister. So I'd go over there and I'd meet with George. And George had lost 100 pounds in Weight Watchers. I, on the other hand, was 6'3 and weighed 145 pounds. I looked like an antenna. And so I'd go to meet with George and he'd give me Weight Watchers cookies and ice cream. And he said, it's okay, Mickey, it has vitamins. I would have drunk gunpowder. I was like desperate, you know what I mean? And George wouldn't let me go. And so I said, I said, George, I think I'm gay. And he gave me the first of many announcements. He said, Mickey, you're not gay. And I got this concrete block on my shoulders. Information does not come in very easily. So I'm going, no, George, I'm gay. And I said, George, is it possible to be gay and not know it? And he said, yes. And I went, oh, clang, there went the gates of prison, and I'm screwed. And I'm gay, and I've got a wife, and I've got a daughter. And plus, I'm really not doing very well as a human being. And we kept talking like this for these years, and he was so loving and so tolerant. And I just love him. In any event, we came up to a day, and finally George had had enough of this. And so he said, Mickey, in your imagination, I'm going to hold up a picture of a naked woman and a picture of a naked man. Which one do you choose? And I picked the woman. He said, Mickey, you are not gay. So all I can tell you is the title Wrong Way Hannigan would apply to me. I was seated on the horse backwards. I was going nowhere. And final story, I got into AA, and then there was this guy, Don Pritz, and Don was getting, you know, all these speaking engagements, and he would just peel them off to other people. And he told me, Mickey, I got you a gig in Grand Junction, Colorado, which is on the other side of the state, at a pig roast. And so you're supposed to be there on this date. And I go, okay, yep, you got it. The date came, and I get a phone call, and Don says, where are you? I said, I'm at home. And he says, they got a pig roast over there. You're supposed to be there. I said, they can get anybody, because I just didn't matter. And I would pick these big sponsors so I could stand in their shadow, because I meant absolutely nothing. And what I thought was going to happen in sobriety was that I was going to be a janitor, and I was going to live in the basement of my house. I mean, I was in serious, serious trouble. And I had no idea what alcoholism truly was. I would go to meetings. I would come back. Marie would be in the bed. I would lay down on my face on the rug in our living room, and I would beg God to kill me. Because if you can imagine just taking a fish and just put it on the sidewalk, that's what I felt. And I asked, after a very short while, I asked people, I said, when do I get to go home? And it turns out I was home, but it was so alien. I was totally upside down, and I did not know how to operate. And I've been working the steps out of the Big Book from Jump Street for 45 years. I can't tell you how much I love you. I can't tell you how much I love being in a room with people who have the disease that I have, that we share that we have common ground, that we've found a way to get better. And we're going to talk this weekend about get better from what and how. This is my idea of casual conversation. Thank you for listening. So, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All righty. Why don't we take a moment and just pull into the power that brought us here and the power that keeps us here. And then we'll start to talk about our steps.